This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we speak with Mike Bush. He's the founder and CEO of Savvy Aviation about aircraft maintenance. In the news, calling up the Civil Reserve Air Fleet, United Airlines says no duct tape, and unhappy Southwest Airlines pilots. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 667 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. Joining me is Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk Podcast. He's a national CFI of the year. And of course, he's an expert on learning to fly or purchase a Cirrus aircraft.
Hello, Max. Nice to see you and our co-host here in the video setup. As we talked about just a moment ago, I'm here in Studio B tonight. Different camera, different view, so less junk to be seen in the camera. So that's why I'm here.
Looks like a real office or something behind you with a bookcase. And have you actually read all those books on that bookcase? Or
I wrote some of those books on that bookcase.
Very good. All right. Also with us is Rob Mark. He's the former senior editor of Flying Magazine. And, of course, he's the publisher of the Jetwine blog.
Hey, good evening to everybody. Welcome to you guys on the East Coast that almost got flooded out.
Yeah, the damp coast. It's pretty soggy around here. David Vanderhoof is also with us, our aviation historian. David, you had a little bit of water in the museum.
Yeah, we got a perfect storm, unquote, unquote. Our roof leaked a little bit as we got hit by severe winds, a couple of tornadoes that touched down in the immediate vicinity of the museum. Luckily, we didn't have any damage other than I spent the morning mopping Thursday. But other than that, I'm looking forward to a good show tonight. And it was good to see Hillel over the weekend. I'm sorry if I didn't get to see anybody on Saturday when we were down and in flight. Kind of was an unusual event, and a very structured event. Hopefully next year, I've been told that they're going to hopefully we'll be able to go back to the good old days and we'll be able to have the gang there. So looking forward to conversations and something that I thought everybody knew, but clearly it didn't come up in the conversation. So we better get started then.
Okay. All right. This episode, we have a guest interview with Mike Bush. He's the founder and CEO of Savvy Aviation. Now, our friend Hillel recorded a conversation with Mike a few days ago, since we weren't able to get schedules to align. As many of you know, Savvy Aviation provides aircraft maintenance services for the owner-flown general aviation industry. They offer professional maintenance management and consulting, a nationwide 24/7 breakdown assistance service, engine monitor data analysis, and predictive analysis. As for Mike, he's a well-known aviation writer, teacher, aircraft owner, advocate, and entrepreneur. He assists aircraft owners with their maintenance problems through his lectures, articles, and his books. Mike was the National Aviation Maintenance Technician of the Year in 2008, and he was previously our guest way back in episode 446. So we will have that interview coming up. But first, we have some news from the past week. Are you guys ready?
We're ready from the West.
Yeah. Go.
First item comes from the Hill. Pentagon offers civilian airlines to assist in Afghanistan evacuation. Now, the Pentagon has activated the Civil Reserve Air Fleet so that commercial airlines can assist with the Afghanistan evacuation. And 18 aircraft will be provided by American Airlines, Atlas Air, Delta Airlines, Omni Air, Hawaiian Airlines, and United Airlines. And these will support the evacuation of U.S. citizens and personnel, also those with special immigrant visa applicants and other at-risk individuals from Afghanistan. This will complement more than 150 military cargo aircraft that are currently being used there. And this is kind of an interesting thing, this Civil Reserve Air Fleet. Not too many people understand us exactly what that is. But I guess, David, it's a relationship. It's an agreement between certain airlines and the U.S. government, the Department of Defense.
It goes back to the Berland Airlift, where the U.S. government needed an excess amount of transports, which it didn't have, and started recruiting airline aircraft to support the Berland Airlift. It's been used twice before. The first time it was actually used, believe it or not, was 1990 for the deployment in Operation Desert Shield. And basically what it says is that the airlines agree to provide aircraft within 24, 48, or 72 hours, as well as crews, to help facilitate airlift mobility. Just like we have the Sealift Command, which is also a civilian-run operation. So basically, these airlines are providing transport. Now, they are not flying into Kabul. They are acting as transports for secondary. So military aircraft are flying out of Kabul, but then, say, Delta and United and the other airlines that are participating are flying them from the second stretch, from like from Qatar and from Germany, to bring them here to the States or whatever nation that is accepting the visa individuals are. But it's basically an agreement saying that we're going to back you up when resources are stretched. It's a force multiplier.
And it really is a contractual obligation. The airlines contractually pledge aircraft to the various segments of this process. There's a domestic version of this. There's an international version of this in, I guess, two flavors, long range and short range. The airlines have this contractual obligation that sign up for this, but they get something out of it as well. They get opportunities to provide cargo lift for the military in other situations. So there's, I guess, the prospect of some revenue in, I'll call them, normal times when this hasn't been activated, and that's what the airlines get out of it.
And believe it or not, some of the airlines used that additional revenue during the last airline crisis, where they were flying additional cargo on behalf of the federal government.
And then there are also different stages of activation. Stage one is for minor regional crises, as well as humanitarian assistance, disaster relief efforts. Stage two can be used for a major theater war. And stage three, for periods of national mobilization. In order to activate this, the commander, U.S. Transportation Command, authorizes this with approval of the Secretary of Defense. Right, that activation authority is used for all three of those stages I mentioned. And Air Mobility Command notes that each stage of this activation is only used to the extent necessary to provide the amount of civil augmentation airlift needed by the Department of Defense. As David mentioned, when notified of a call-up, the response time is either 24, 48, or 72 hours, depending on which stage is activated. And the air carriers operate and maintain the aircraft with their resources, but the Air Mobility Command controls the aircraft missions. So it's not a matter of the airlines handing over these airplanes to the government. They fly them and operate them and maintain them. And like you say, David, this is only the third time this has ever been activated.
Yeah, but it's a useful force multiplier. And in this situation, it's alleviating the burden on secondary flights. So the primary focus for the military is to get people out of the Hamid Karzai airfield. And they're using these as secondary transport. So they're not going in harm's way, and they're basically force multipliers. So it benefits the airlines because they get benefits every year, and they've only had them called up three times in 30-plus years. So in all fairness, it's not a bad deal for them. And I'm sure that this will only go on for a couple more weeks. So a couple of weeks giving up a couple of airplanes for a load of money during the rest of the time, the airlines can't complain about it.
And we should mention that the airlines are paid for each of these flights. So, for example, the Secretary of Defense determines a fair and reasonable rate of payment for the flights. And I was intrigued to see that the crews receive extra pay for the flights as well, too, which probably makes sense because a lot of these are, they've been called up on short notice. They're flying perhaps longer routes than they're used to. I mean, you think about a company like Southwest where, the average flight's probably an hour, and now suddenly they're probably doing some really long flights. And I think it makes a lot of sense because it keeps the military airlift command aircraft in the theater. So they're not having to do double and triple hops to get these people to their destination. They're just doing that first hop to pull people out of Afghanistan, and the Civil Reserve Air Fleet is helping them out on the second and the third hop. So I think it's a really efficient strategy, and it kind of benefits everyone.
And the other part of that is you're not putting civilians into harm's way flying the last mission into the hostile airspace. So everybody benefits from this in all ways.
Well, the other thing is, if you look at some of these military aircraft, one of them, I think, came out with 1,000 people on board. That's just not going to happen if you were to take a Southwest 737. You're going to fill those 137 seats, and that's it. So in some ways, it's really a lot more effective to use the military airlift to get them out, because they can waive a lot of the rules in terms of how people are seated and how many you put on the airplane.
Well, don't forget that some of these flights also, in a lighter note, arrived at their destinations with one more person than they took off with, since the Pentagon announced that they've had three berths aboard flights coming out of Afghanistan. So it's not often you get to hear about a flight taking off and landing with an additional person aboard.
Wow. I wonder what the nationality of what that person is. If they're – obviously, if the parents are – U.S. citizens, then it's set. But if you've got a berth from an Afghan woman on a U.S. military flight, what's the in someone else's airspace, what's the nationality?
I don't know. And I don't think Globemaster is a great name for a child.
Yeah.
And neither is Barney, or which is the other nickname for the Globemaster. So.
But you know what's going to make this interesting is that today is the 23rd, and the Taliban announced today that they're not giving any extensions to the Americans getting out of Afghanistan. And so what happens if they don't have all the people out on time? And the Russians said today that they're willing to jump in and help evacuate people from Kabul. So that should add an interesting twist to this. And what would the Taliban do if they went to September 2nd? I can't believe they would want to risk a confrontation with any of the allied powers, not just the U.S., but the Brits, the Germans, the French were also there. I mean, while I think they'll get a lot of people out, it's going to be interesting to see what happens after the end of the month.
And we also need to remember that this is a NATO operation. While the U.S. was the primary, there are Germans there, there are Canadians, there are English, and a lot of other NATO countries. So,
say that?
No.
Have you?
Yes,
been listening?
You did. No, I'm sorry, Rob. I'm sorry. I stepped all over you.
No, it will be interesting though to see if they're willing to pick a fight with anybody. But you know what I would think is that if I were one of these civil guys, flying a United flight, I'm glad they're obviously not taking those airplanes into Kabul. But with the Taliban surrounding the airport, It's not a real fun place I'd want to be in any airplane, civil or military.
Yeah, I think it's a fragile situation as well. There are so many parties and factions and things involved in what's going on in that city now that, you know, all it takes is some guy or a couple of guys who do something not particularly intelligent to spark a big, you know, conflagration or something.
Well, look at what happened in Tehran. Was it last year or the year before when the missile batteries guarding the airport shot down a civilian airliner by mistake?
Right. Yeah, anything can happen. So hopefully things will progress without too much craziness. You know, we're all hoping for that, I think.
Speaking of craziness.
Yeah, that's exactly. Took the words right out of my mouth.
Okay.
We talked about duct tape last time. Rob, United Airlines has apparently issued a memo to crews concerning use of duct tape.
Well, they don't want them to use it. I don't believe they really came up with a great alternative, but let's just cut to the chase. As contributor Micah just horned in on the whole story, even though he's not here, and he mentioned that it's not really duct tape as we know it, and it was simply, what did he call it? It was something
restraint
like
tape.
Restraint tape that sticks to itself but doesn't stick to your, what is it? What is the candy that used to be, sticks to your hands but it doesn't? I don't know. Oh, that was M&M's. Remember? Melts in your mouth, but not
melts
on your
hands.
Well, this is kind of like that. Because people thought it was cruel and unusual punishment to restrain somebody. And we talked about that a little bit last week, that, well, what if there's an emergency? You know what? I'm sorry. As Spock said once, you know, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. And what is a flight attendant supposed to do when a passenger's just lost their mind? You can't risk the other, harm to the other people. That's not right. So you know what? Duct tape, adhesive tape, whatever you call it. My vote is for tough.
Yeah, I think there certainly needs to be a way for the crew to subdue or incapacitate a passenger who presents a danger to themselves or to the flight. I don't know a lot about restraint tape, although I figured this would be an opportunity to learn about restraint tape. But if you try to research restraint tape, then you find yourself very quickly into the world of bondage and that kind of thing. it was hard to find anything about restraint tape in a law enforcement context. But hey, I don't know, maybe it's all the same stuff. What I did find is there's kind of a Velcro equivalent. There's something called RIP, R-I-P-P, RIP Law Enforcement Quick Cuffs, which is basically a length of Velcro. And the idea is, you know, you wrap this around someone's wrists the way you would with handcuffs, but it's, you know, it's Velcro, so it's, I don't think it would injure anyone. But regardless of what's there, yeah, I think that the crew needs to be able to restrain passengers, but not, you know, not as the first choice. And I think as the airlines, in fact, United says this, I think, in their communication to their crews, is that you really want to try to de-escalate the situation. The first step should not be reaching for the tape, but try to de-escalate it. Of course, you need to be trained in de-escalation techniques and things. It's, you know, it's not something that, you know, the average person knows how to do. But if that doesn't work, I don't know. I mean, you need to be able to tie them down or tape them down somehow.
Well, and I think they do have some type of, you know, zip tie, you know, wrist restraints on aircraft. And I think that was the point of the United memo was, hey, we've got stuff on the airplane that you're supposed to use when you're trying to restrain a passenger. Please don't innovate and start, you know, using tape, whatever kind of tape it is, to, you know, secure the passenger. But I think United is particularly sensitive because they were the ones that had the incident back in 2017 where some poor doctor got dragged off their flight because of a misunderstanding. And I think there were missing teeth and other things like that. And that was just a huge public relations disaster. So I think they're trying to make sure that their cabin staff, doesn't get them into that kind of, problem in the future. But I think probably the best thing to de-escalate these is just to serve less alcohol on the airplane. And I have read that this has gone back and forth with different airlines. You know, some have returned to serving liquor again. Others have postponed starting the serving liquor again, and so on. But I think there's a good correlation between some of the incidents and the amount of alcohol consumed.
Yeah, it would be nice to know what that data shows. I mean, of the, I don't know how many, couple of thousand incidents that the FAA has recorded concerning unruly passengers so far this year. Maybe you don't know in all cases, but it would be interesting to learn how many of those where alcohol played, a role. I have a feeling it's not a small number, but I don't really know.
And let's be serious, the incidents themselves are primarily being sparked by people that don't want to wear a mask because they feel it's their stomping on their civil liberties to make them wear a mask. As we said last week, nobody questions the logic or the authority to make you wear a seatbelt, but here it's different. So God only knows where this is going to end.
You know, it's interesting on the seatbelt thing. It took probably 2-3 decades to get the seatbelt compliance up anywhere close to 90%. So that was something that took a really long time for the public to take on and own and start participating in. So, we may have a similar curve here, which is just takes some people a lot of time to accept that. And of course, the airlines are stuck in the middle. This is an FAA mandate. They don't have a choice. They're just enforcing the FAA rules for now. So they really are in a tough position.
Yeah, they are. They are. Someone else who seems to be in a tough position these days are the pilots, maybe the Southwest Airlines pilots. Dallas News reports Southwest Airlines pilots ready to picket over frustration and chaos of summer flying increase.
Not enough pilots.
Yeah, Southwest has always had great relations with their employees and been regarded as a good employer. But they were one of the airlines that ramped up the hardest and the fastest to try and capture market share as the economy started to recover toward the end of the first year of the pandemic. And apparently they really went a little bit too far. And so pilots and cabin staff are having to work overtime, and people are just getting tired of this. And so the pilots union has said that if things continue like this, they may picket in the fourth quarter, specifically around Thanksgiving and Christmas, which is the busy time for the airlines. So they really don't want to see picket lines at that particular time of year, because that's not going to look very good. And the airline was fairly quick to respond. In a separate article, they apologized to staff after the unions complained about the grueling schedules this summer, and they said that they were considering changes for later in the year to come up with scheduling that's not going to be quite as onerous for the pilots. Interestingly, if you look at the period from June 1st to August 18th, Southwest only had a 64% on-time arrival rate. I mean, that is horrendous.
Wow.
Yeah, historically, we've seen numbers that in the high 80s, low 90s. I mean, things are just not working very well. The airline did tell the union that they are reversing course on plans to add 720 crew assignments to the schedule in September, which was resulted in a lot of the overtime that pilots have been complaining about. So it sounds like they have taken the first step to try and back off and not work the employees quite as hard as they used to. Now, the other thing is, if they had more employees, this would be less of a problem. So they just announced that they're going to start rewarding staff with bonuses worth $300 if they refer to someone for a job at the carrier. So that incentive program will hopefully help employees make a little money as they also bring new employees into the company.
Well, and realize, too, it's not just the pilots. Flight attendants are getting hammered as well. And when you try to run that many segments, ground crew get really exhausted because it doesn't matter how fast the airplanes come in. If you can't get the bags off and get them to the people in the terminal that are waiting once they get to wherever they're headed, that always drives people crazy. Sitting waiting, where are the bags? I don't know. We've been here half an hour. Where are the bags? And so again, it's a ripple effect all through the company, but Southwest has had, as Max said, some of the worst on time, but they've also had the most horrendous number of flight cancellations over the last couple of months. And so altogether, it's not pretty. And guess what airline I'm flying next week when I go to L.A.?
Southwest, right?
Same with me. I've got a flight on Friday to Denver as well, Southwest. So I've got my fingers crossed.
How did you guess that? How did you know that?
Just wow, brilliant, I guess.
You guys are smart.
We're yep. good.
So, and unfortunately, I took one that had a connection, which is not usually what I do, but I'm testing out a new process here because they started flying out of O'Hare last year, and so I'm going to go through out of O'Hare through Phoenix, and so we'll see if I make the Phoenix flight.
Hmm. Well, there is a video. I guess it was produced by the union, and you can see that video in the Dallas News article that we'll have in the show notes. But it includes a group of line pilots, I guess, and they're talking about some of the issues they have, things like lack of food, lack of accommodations, and lots of reassignments, jump seat denials, unanswered phone calls, scheduling, things like this. And, there was one thing about this video that caught my eye. I don't know if you guys picked up on this as well, but there were 23 pilots arranged, together in this video. And did you notice anything about the 23 pilots? Of the 23 pilots, one was a woman. That was it. One woman and 22 men. I thought that was a pretty surprising ratio.
I don't think that reflects the company ratio. I would imagine that it's probably at least 10% of the pilots are female at this point.
Yeah, and you think you would want to represent that diversity in the group that you were, putting together in this video. But again, I think this video comes from the union, I think, from SWAPA. Not from the company itself, but still, you need to think about these things.
Yeah, and just to clarify on my 10% guess, if you look at the pilot population as a whole, I think it's still about 6% are women. But if you take just the commercial pilots, last I looked at it was around 18% of people who held a commercial pilot's license were female. And so I think that just reflects how a higher percentage of females are career-oriented. And I don't know that 18% is fully reflected in the airlines at this point in time. But I'm guessing it's over 10% at this point.
All right. Well, as I mentioned when we opened up, Hillel had a conversation with Mike Bush, the founder and CEO of Savvy Aviation, and we will we'll play that interview right now. Now, during the course of the interview, Hillel mentions some of the terminology, and through the course of the conversation, there's a lot of acronyms, a lot of terminology thrown around. The pilot community, I think, will already know what most of these things mean. But Hillel also produced a little well, a description, some definitions of some of the terms used. And so we'll put that later in the podcast episode, probably using chapters. Now, I don't know if you all are aware of it, but podcasts can have something called chapters, and many of the better podcast apps recognize chapters. And it's a way to jump around to different sections within a podcast episode. And so if your app does that, you can even, if you choose, go listen to the definitions first and then go back and listen to the interview. Or if you listen to the interview and don't need the definitions explained to you, then you can just skip ahead with that. So here's Hillel and Mike Bush from Savvy Aviation.
This is Hillel Glazer, entrepreneurship and innovation correspondent for the Airplane Geeks podcast. I'm here with the engineer's engineer, mechanic's mechanic, an engineer's mechanic, and a mechanic's engineer, a legend in his own time, Mike Bush of Savvy Aviation. Mike, welcome back to the Airplane Geeks podcast. It's been at least 4 years since you've been on with us.
Well, nice to be here, Hillel. Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, we tried to squeeze you in an interview with you at Oshkosh, but that was just an exercise in futility. How many talks did you give this year?
13, count them. 13 different forums. It was, I think it was an all-time high, and I think I'm probably going to ask them to do a few less next year because it was, I wish I could go to Oshkosh and just sort of have fun. It was very, very busy, but it was a great show. The weather largely cooperated. There was one storm that came through, but it missed Oshkosh by about 10 miles. But no, it was a very nice show.
Yes, indeed. It was a great show. I mean, and we were among the evacuees for that storm. So we ended up spending several hours in the museum that night.
Oh, good. Oh, you were camping.
Yeah,
oh,
we were camping.
Well, it looked pretty scary. That's for sure.
It was an impressive light show for all accounts. Something interceded on our part and decided that half the storm was going to come to us and the worst of the storm was going to go west by, like you said, 10 miles. It was amazing. But yes, and I visited your forums a number of times, and I can tell you and everybody else that they are standing room only sellouts, so to speak, like every one of them. You're so generous with your time and your knowledge, you can't seem to get people to stop wanting to not only your attention, but to pay you for stuff. As a business consultant in my day job, you're one of my consulting heroes. I mean, people just like, the more you give away, the more people want to give you more. And then after your forums, you're stuck. They won't let you leave because you're so because you're so generous with your time. I was standing in a crowd and people were peppering you with question after question, and you just patiently, you know, we're trying to help them and understand their situation. And I have pictures of this. I'm going to put them in the show notes. Even pilots who want to do what they want to do, which isn't the right thing to do, and they still want the outcomes that you're suggesting, but they'd have to change what they do. And you know, it's so generous. So I really want to thank you for your time and for your generosity of spirit and generosity of your knowledge.
Well, it was fun. It's my annual pilgrimage. I've been doing it for decades now, and hope to be able to continue.
Yeah, we'll talk a little bit about the origins of the company and your idea behind what was needed and what was being filled. So I wanted to give a little bit of context for our listeners who may not have heard you for something years ago. I had heard about you, as many pilots and owners have, but I'd heard about you long ago. I didn't really start following a lot of your work until several years after I owned a plane. And it was specifically when you were on our co-host Max Trescott's Aviation News Talk podcast. And it was June or somewhere around June, spring of 2018. And on that episode, you said something to the effect of mechanics solve problems with tools and parts, not diagnostics.
Yeah, I the way I like to characterize it is that A&Ps are trained to be the surgeons of aviation, not the radiologists or pathologists.
That's a generous way of saying it. That really did resonate with me because at that very moment, I was having a problem with my engine temperature gauge, for example. And so the story goes that after having a shop install an engine monitor, the oil temperature gauge in my end, the analog one, stopped working. As it turns out, when I picked up the plane, the yoke, I was doing my pre-flight checks, and the yoke immediately caught on some harness under the dash. And when I tried to move the yoke, it wouldn't go back. So if I pulled it all the way back without having checked, I would have ended up in a pitch up attitude on takeoff, and I would have never recovered. At least it would have been hard. And we ended up working that out, and I was able to, you know, we restrung some harness in behind. But when I told him about the temperature gauge, his immediate approach was to replace the temperature probe, and that didn't fix it. And his next idea was order and replace the gauge itself. And then in the back of my mind, so this has already happened. Now I hear you on the podcast and you're saying, you know, mechanics solve problems with tools and parts. And I, as an engineer, also had a hunch that the yoke catching on a harness probably caught the same wire that was providing something to the temperature gauge. And so I actually said, you know, hold off on the temperature gauge. I'm going to go get somebody who's local to me because my mechanic isn't local. And we're going to jerry rig a temporary power wire from the breaker bus to the gauge so I can see just is the current gauge actually broken. And voila, like magic, it worked. So no expensive replacement required.
Yeah, so you lost power to the gauge, basically.
That's it. When the yoke caught, it pulled the power wire out of the back of the gauge, and that was it. So instead of trying to fix that, we simply replaced the power wire with a new power wire, and off to the races we go. That was so valuable, I immediately sent Max Trescott a pretty big donation for turning me on to you and your way of seeing things.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I always hate to make sweeping generalizations about A&Ps because they're all individual, and there are some absolutely incredible mechanics out there that we work with. But an awful lot of A&Ps are scared of electrons. You know, they're comfortable with mechanical stuff. They're comfortable with hydraulic stuff, but electrons are invisible, and they're green, and they're just scary. And you know, often a problem that involves electricity is hard to get resolved unless you either have a mechanic who isn't scared of electrons or take the airplane to an avionics shop. One of the most telling questions you can ask a mechanic is, can I borrow your multimeter? And that opens up all sorts of possibilities, because first of all, if he says, gee, I used to have one, but I'm not sure where it is, that's not a good sign. Or if he produces it for you and it still looks like it's brand new in the box and never been used, that's not a good sign either.
Yeah, you know, I think the piece though that electrons or mechanics or oil aside, I think the biggest differentiator in one of your approaches compared to many others is that you really are about the diagnostics and about the analysis piece.
Yeah,
you know, you're, like you said, the radiologist or the other specialists who try to figure out what the problem is before they try to fix it. You know, and you know, not every patient coming into the ER is a gunshot wound where you don't have a lot of analysis to do. You know, sometimes there's patients that need more analysis, like, and planes too. Just do some more analysis before you try to fix the problem.
Right.
It's the
And you know, nowadays we have so many really good non-invasive tools that we didn't used to have. We don't always have to do exploratory surgery. In fact, we try as much as possible in my practice, where we manage the maintenance of, you know, 1,000 airplanes, to try to avoid doing things invasively unless it's absolutely necessary.
Just like in surgery, anything invasive is going to be more expensive than anything that's, you
know. It's also going to be more risky.
Yes.
And we, you know, I've written a lot and talked a lot about the issue of maintenance-induced failures, which is the kind of the dirty little secret of aircraft maintenance that nobody wants to talk about. But mechanics are constantly breaking airplanes in the attempt to fix them. And your thing about your
engine job monitor,
your gauge losing its power is a perfect example. You know, that was a maintenance induced issue.
Yeah. So hopefully this sets the story and the stage for you and for Savvy Aviation, which has been around for about 13 years, if I recall. Could you fill us in, please, on what it is, why you started it, and you know, what was the impetus? What problems are you solving?
Well, I started Savvy Aviation in 2008, and when we started it, it was basically devoted to a single service, which is what we now call Savvy MX, which was maintenance management. If you happen to fly a Gulfstream or a Challenger, you don't just drop it off at the shop and say, here are the keys, call me when it's done. You send somebody with the airplane who is typically an A&P mechanic who works for you, and he represents your interest during the maintenance event, and he is the one that is there to make decisions on what maintenance should be done and what maintenance shouldn't be done and how it should be done. And but if you own a Bonanza, if you owned a Bonanza in 2008, you couldn't afford to have an A&P representing your interests who was there at the shop looking out for you. And I thought, well, gee, you know, we're now in a new world of interconnectedness with all of these knowledge projecting technologies. Everybody is carrying a high resolution camera. Everybody is connected to the internet. We ought to be able to do that for the Bonanza owner, for the Cirrus owner, for the Cessna 172 owner. And we ought to be able to do it virtually. Obviously, they can't afford to do it physically and hire somebody that babysits the airplane while it's in the shop, but we can do it virtually. So that's what we started the company doing. And since then, in the last 13 years, we've diversified a lot. And now we offer a whole palette of different services. But what connects them together is that they're all related to the maintenance of owner flow and general aviation airplanes. 98% of our work or piston-powered airplanes, piston singles and twins, and overwhelmingly singles. But we now have a large consulting practice, something called Savvy QA, where we provide referrals and second opinions and diagnostic help and so on. Something less than full-on maintenance management, but it's the right fit for an awful lot of owners. We probably about a third of our business is involved in doing data analysis for aircraft owners. We are really the only company that does that. We created a platform called Savvy Analysis that is a platform to which engine monitor data from virtually any make or model engine monitor, both certificated and experimental, can be uploaded. There's a lot of tools that you can use to look at it for owners that want to analyze their own data, and we provide that platform free. And then if you want our analysts, we have a team of about a dozen trained analysts whose job it is to look at this data and do diagnostics based on the data. And so we offer a program called Savvy Analysis Pro that's $129 a year for single, and It provides unlimited data analysis and all sorts of other things, some very exciting predictive analytics and reports. We have something called a report card that we send out based on engine monitor data. We have trend analysis reports that we send out. It's a whole bunch of stuff. We started, about 5 or 6 years ago, we started a service called Savvy Breakdown because I realized that nobody was offering the general aviation equivalent to AAA. somebody's on a trip with their airplane and they run into trouble. You know, who are you going to call if you're away from home, away from, you know, your trusted mechanic or shop or whatever, and you're stuck somewhere? And so We offer a 24/7 hotline for aircraft owners to call, and within 15 minutes, it's usually closer to 5 minutes, one of our IAs will be on the phone with you, walking you through a diagnosis, trying to figure out whether the problem is a safety of flight issue, or it's one that you can live with and fly home or fly to your the next point in your trip and get it resolved. And if it's a safety of flight issue, we take care of lining up whatever resources are necessary to get you back in the air as quickly as possible. And we've got, you know, thousands of aircraft owners enrolled in that program now.
Yeah, I'm one of them.
And then finally, and this is something that it'd be interesting to talk about here in the context of COVID, but we have a very rapidly growing practice in managing pre-buy examinations for airplane people who are buying airplanes and looking to have a pre-buy. Nowadays, most people buy their airplanes, locate their airplanes on the internet. And so it's very, very common that somebody will find an airplane that they're interested in purchasing and it's going to be 2,000 miles away. And it's hard for them to go see the airplane. It's hard for them to line up a pre-buy because, you know, who are they going to have do the pre-buy in that in some area that they're not familiar with? So we some years ago, we established a national pre-buy management program called Savvy Pre-Buy. And it has absolutely exploded, and particularly during the pandemic. I'm not exactly sure why, but during the period of pandemic lockdown, if you will, there's been an absolute explosion in airplanes changing hands. The market is hotter than I've ever seen it before. And, you know, when there's an explosion of airplanes changing hands, there's an explosion of pre-buys. So our business in pre-buys went up by a factor of five over the past year. We used to be doing maybe 20 pre-buys at any given moment. We're now doing over 100 at any given moment. It's absolutely incredible. In fact, we've been hiring more IAs to be part of the team because it's just been such an explosion in workload. And I'm not exactly sure why it happened, but you know, my theory is that the COVID thing was one of these things that created a lot of winners and a lot of losers. You know, if you had a brick and mortar business, it really, really hurt you. If you had a virtual business, you know, Savvy is a totally virtual business. It didn't affect you much. And if you had the right virtual business, if you were like Zoom Communications or something, your business went through the roof. Or if you were some little unknown medical company called Moderna, and all of a sudden you're on the map big time. And so, you know, my theory is that, you know, if you're hurt by COVID and you need to, you know, pull back, one of the first things you're going to probably do is sell your airplane. And if you were not hurt by COVID, you're going to see an opportunity to buy an airplane. I don't know that that's the proper explanation. It's the only one I can think of. But what I do know for a fact is that the market in used airplanes just has gone absolutely berserk. It's just absolutely incredible. And we were very fortunate that this one aspect of our business that in doing pre-buys was just happened to be positioned in the right place to benefit from it. When the COVID thing started, we were very frightened and we started pulling back on expenses. We reduced our software engineering budget and things. And then all of a sudden things turned a corner and started to go vertical.
About how far into the pandemic do you think that corner did you turn?
You know, I was looking at a chart the other day, but I think maybe April or May of last year, things started just exploding.
So about 2 months into the pandemic, essentially.
Yeah, we had kind of 2 months where revenue seemed to be declining, and we thought, oh, my God. And we had the same reaction that probably an awful lot of business people had, that, boy, we're going to have to pull in. Of course, that tends to be a self-fulfilling prophecy when that happens. But it wasn't 2 months before all of a sudden things started picking up in a fashion that was so dramatic that we weren't even prepared for it, and we were really scrambling to keep up.
Yeah, that is a really fascinating. I'm hearing similar stories in, you know, when I was at Oshkosh and asking these kinds of questions, and people were like, yeah, things, and like, I think everybody, even in my own business, we pulled back for a couple of months because we just didn't know what was ahead. Right. And then I think it did, once we got our legs under us a little bit, we started to see, well, we could continue just a little bit differently. And every other business that could continue a little bit differently started, you know, picking things up. And then at the same time, I think we, like you said, there were winners and losers. And among the things that the winners were able to do was to recognize that, wow, I have a lot more time for all those things that the only reason I'm not doing them is because I didn't have enough time. And so a lot of people and individuals were like, hey, I've got time for this now. So, you know, they're not commuting. They're getting more work done because they're not, you know, they're not spending a lot of time with the things that just take time but not adding value. So suddenly people had time and were able to keep things afloat.
Yeah, I think it took people a little while to adapt to the new way of doing things. And a lot of people, I mean, I've been working at home since the 1970s, so this was not a change for me, but a lot of people weren't used to that. And that's just a whole different set of disciplines.
Yeah.
Than when you go into the office. Nowadays, more and more and more, the economy is based on knowledge work rather than anything that's physical. And if you were in a knowledge-related business, you were very well positioned with regard to the pandemic, I think.
Yeah. In fact, I wanted to go there on the knowledge work piece of what Savvy Aviation does. But before I do, wanted to disclose I am a Savvy Aviation breakdown customer. And it's for lots of good reasons. It wasn't just invaluable advice when I needed it. It was an invaluable education. Thanks to the person, whoever's on the phone, who I believe was in Ohio. So the picture is my plane is stuck in New Jersey. I'm back home in Baltimore, and the Savvy Aviation mechanic was in Ohio. And so
that was probably Tony if he was in Ohio. We've got people all over the place. It's kind of the nature of the virtual business that.
Yeah, and he and I were able to identify and solve the problem in one phone call. I had been speaking to a few other mechanics who were not also available either, but he corroborated for me what the mechanics who knew what they were talking about were, you know, what we're saying, and which mechanics to stop listening to, and and why. And sure enough, within a phone call or a couple of phone calls later, we had a plan to solve the problem, and we solved it. And I went back to the plane, did the solution, and off I went. It was great. But anyway, enough of that commercial. The piece that you really mentioned a number of times is data analytics and diagnostics, and that's the knowledge work thing. And I think what a lot of us are more comfortable as pilots and owners. We're more comfortable looking at the analytics and the diagnostics and saying, look, every day we are awash in information and data and bits and bytes. And a lot of it just doesn't make any sense. But with today's tools, you know, we started this conversation talking about my new engine monitor. I'll tell you, after hearing one of your talks, I don't remember when, I immediately called my mechanic and said, hey, where's the port on my engine monitor to download all the data? Yeah. And
it's amazing how many people we talk to who, you know, they say, we got a problem. We say, well, could you download your engine monitor data so we can take a look at it? And he said, well, how do you do that? I've never done that. And, you know, it's just amazing how many people have engine monitors and think of them somehow as like leaning gauges.
Right.
I mean, that's the least of what they do. In fact, I teach people how to lean, and I say, don't look at your engine monitor when you lean. But what the engine monitor really is it's the most amazing device for allowing us to look inside of the combustion chambers of your engine while it's running and figure out what the heck is going on. And nowadays, a lot of the engine monitors instrument lots of other stuff besides engines. We can look at the electrical system. Like, for example, we manage the maintenance of a lot of Cirruses, which have a pretty complicated electrical system. It's a dual bus electrical system with dual alternators and dual batteries and, you know, all sorts of diodes connecting buses and stuff. And we are able to look at the engine monitor data. We should be using a different term for that now because it's now the aircraft monitor.
Right.
Not the engine monitor specifically. And diagnose electrical problems. I remember we had a guy a few years ago call in. He was on a round the world flight in a Cirrus, and he was stuck in Iceland. He was stuck in Reykjavik with an electrical problem, and none of the mechanics in Reykjavik had ever seen a Cirrus before, and they had no idea about the electrical system. And they were telling him that he was going to have to order a $3,000 box to be airshipped in from Cirrus and stuff. And so we had him download his data. We took a look at it, and we said, no, there's nothing wrong with that box. It's this other thing, and it's okay to fly to the UK, and there's a good service center there that can take care of it when you get there. So we got him rescued from Reykjavik, but it's amazing what you can do with this data nowadays. It's an incredibly powerful diagnostic tool.
Yeah, and with all this data and our ability to really see what's happening with the aircraft and to apply some science to what we see and not just tools to solve problems, you've been a really strong advocate for at least from an engine perspective, flying the engines to where they're optimal, to when the engine is operating at its peak. Like there's it's physics, it's chemistry, it's metallurgy, and all these things work together. And there are places where the engine performs really, really well optimally that's completely safe because chemically things aren't going to change, you know, because the chemistry only works. You know, you've got something that only combusts at this temperature or in this temperature range. It's not going to combust at these other temperature ranges or whatever. So we know from the science and the metallurgy where those numbers are. And I've heard you explain about some of the certification processes that don't really look at it that way. And the way the certifications are done for engines and other parts often are really to grease the skids of the certification process and not necessarily to optimize how the product is used. And in this case, we're talking engines. And that, you know, that those ways of really optimizing how we use the engine from the real world needs of real world pilots and owners are not always what is in the handbook or in the performance charts. Can you help us understand what that's all about?
Well, for the most part, the majority of the GA fleet are airplanes that were certified under the old CAR-3 regulations, whose POHs were written, you know, back in the 60s and 70s when we really didn't know very much about how to optimally operate an engine because it wasn't possible to instrument things back then the way we can now. I need to say that my friend George Brawley down in Ada, Oklahoma, who founded General Aviation's Modifications, Inc., and has set up what I think is by far the most sophisticated piston aircraft engine test stand in the world, aeronautical engineer, one of the smartest guys I've ever met. And he basically single-handedly taught most of us everything we now know about what the right way is to operate these engines. And it's radically different than what the conventional wisdom was back in the days when our POHs were written. You know, that's not to criticize the people who wrote the POHs. It's just we didn't know back then. We didn't have the ability to instrument things and see what was going on in real time inside the cylinders.
So if I understand you correctly, what we've learned from this greater insight and technology to understand what's going on is, for example, contrary to my POH, as long as I'm willing to spend whatever fuel burn I might be doing at a higher fuel flow rate and RPM, as long as it's within safe operating temperatures, which we may not have known when the POH was written. So, you know, as long as I'm willing to operate within the temperatures of the cylinder head temperature and the exhaust gas temperature, from a chemical, metallurgical, and economical perspective, there's no reason to ever run the engine at a lower RPM just because it's we think of it as maybe safer or better. If I'm actually burning more efficiently at a higher RPM, at a marginally higher fuel flow rate, then if I understand you correctly, what you're saying is it's actually better for the longevity of the engine and the overall cost of ownership to run where the engine is more efficient.
Well, I agree with the last thing you said. I'm not sure I agree with the example you gave about RPM, because I've been a very strong proponent of operating engines at high manifold pressure and low RPM, and that's how I've operated my engines and taken them to, you know, 250% of TBO, doing it that way. It's not something I invented. You know, Charles Lindbergh was teaching aviators in World War II how to get vastly greater range out of their aircraft by operating over square. I don't think they called it over square back then, but that was in essence what it was. But you know, when I bought my first airplane in 1968, I was 24 years old at the time. First airplane that I had flown that had a controllable pitch prop. My flight instructor, you know, gave me this big lecture about how you never are allowed to let manifold pressure get greater than RPM divided by 100. And if you did, you're going to blow the cylinder heads right off the cylinder barrels. And so don't ever do that. And, you know, it took me about 7 years before I realized that he was full of baloney and that as it happened, by then I was flying a Blanca Super Viking, and I was doing public benefit flying for a group called the Flying Samaritans. We would be flying medical teams down into remote areas of Mexico, where we basically would usually have to tanker enough fuel to go down there and come back, and range was like super critical. And discovered that what Lindbergh taught back in World War II is absolutely true. You could get operate much, much more efficiently at higher manifold pressures and lower RPMs. And nowadays, I fly a turbocharged twin where I'm typically operating 10 to 12 inches over square all the time. People who fly with me are kind of shocked because I push the throttles all the way forward on takeoff, and then I tie wrap them in place and don't touch them until I'm ready to land the airplane. And obviously the engines like it an awful lot because they've lasted an awfully long time, but it's not the way people were taught to do it. It's just the best way to do it. And we know a lot more about that. The other big thing that George introduced, and that I have been practicing for decades now is operating lean a peak, which the conventional wisdom was if you did that, you'd destroy your engine. And the actual fact is it's absolutely the kindest thing you can do to the engine. And if you look at the pressure traces of what happens inside of a cylinder when operating rich a peak and lean a peak, it's obvious that when you're operating lean a peak, the pressure pulses are much lower amplitude and spread out over a longer period of time, and it's all much more gentle on the reciprocating components and the rod bearings and all of that sort of stuff. And you know, you also see that, gee, if I'm going to operate lean a peak, I really need to operate at lower RPM, because since the combustion event is taking place in a slower and gentler fashion, it needs more time to play out before the exhaust valve opens up. And in a perfect world, we would give it more time by advancing the ignition timing a little bit. But since most of us are still flying behind fixed-time tractor mags, the way we give it more time is to slow the RPM down, which increases the amount of time between when the spark fires and when the exhaust valve starts to open. So you know, nobody knew this stuff back in the 70s and 60s when all these POHs were being written, but we do now. It's really nice. And to you know, I've had the experience of spending hours in George's test cell down in Ada, Oklahoma, you know, intentionally abusing engines and trying to put them into detonation and stuff and watching all of these pressure traces on the computer screens. It's absolutely fascinating. You do that and you suddenly can start visualizing exactly what's going on inside of your cylinders and what the effect of moving different engine controls in different positions is going to have. I wish every aircraft owner had, you know, could have that experience. It's amazing, and I've tried to capture as much of it as I can in, you know, in the things I write and the talks I give at AirVenture and so on.
Yeah, and unfortunately, we're both kind of running short on time. We could talk about you know, the topics that you've brought up for the next decade. So, but we don't have a decade; we only have a couple of minutes, unfortunately. So, what I'd like to do is to bring this thing into an approach and landing, and some closeout questions. I'm going to provide some definitions separately for a lot of the terminology that we've been throwing around. And so listen for those at the end. Or listen for them in the middle, depending on what Max does. And but what I wanted to ask you, Mike, is what kinds of questions do people come to you with that you don't have a service to offer, or maybe you just choose not to get into? What aspects of aircraft ownership or mechanics, or is there anything that you kind of like, you've said, yeah, we're not going there, or we can't answer that, or that's something for a different part, you know, different kind of business?
Well, we do an awful lot of stuff, to be honest with you. But for example, one of the things that I am not, and we are not, are aircraft appraisers. I can't tell you whether this airplane is fairly priced at X dollars. We don't do that. As far as our maintenance practice, we have made the conscious decision to limit our practice to piston-powered airplanes and single-engine turbine-powered airplanes. Because once you cross the boundary into multi-engine turbines or aircraft above 12,500 pounds gross weight, you're dealing with a whole different set of maintenance regulations, which are much, much more restrictive and give us much less radius of action to help aircraft owners. So we don't do King Airs. We don't do Citations. We do overwhelmingly piston-powered aircraft and mostly owner-flown or aircraft that are, you know, co-owned by a group of people. So that's kind of a hard boundary that we've drawn around our maintenance practice.
Where do you see the company going? Where do you see yourselves? Or what would you like to see, you know, Savvy Aviation go? And what's next for you?
Well, we are spending a lot of time figuring out really interesting things to do with data. We now have, I think the last figure was something like 3.5 million flights of general aviation aircraft data in our database. And with that amount of data, we're able to do some really interesting things. We've been working on, and I've done a little writing about, predictive analytics. We're using machine learning techniques to try to have the computer detect patterns in the data that suggest incipient failures. We've been concentrating on exhaust valve failures. We're working on another project to predict stuck valves, which has been a big problem in Lycoming engines. And there are a lot of other things that are in our pipeline to do with this data. We've been working on a project that I hope will come to fruition very soon to provide telemetry. One of the big problems we have with engine monitor data analysis is that aircraft owners aren't very good about dumping their data. And either they don't ever do it or they do it only when they think something's wrong. And obviously, predictive analytics is based on the thing of saying, well, if you let us look at all of your data, maybe we can tell you when something is going wrong before you actually get to the point where you're aware of it. But that only works if you know, if we get a fairly timely and complete stream of data from the airplane. So one of the things that we've been trying to pull together, and I think we're pretty close now, is a project for providing telemetry, where the data will go from the aircraft into the cloud and onto our platform without the pilot having to put in a thumb drive or pull out an SD card or push a whole bunch of buttons, which is just something that they don't do.
So if the Dustin Hoffman movie The Graduate from the 70s were to be made today, the advice you'd be giving his character today is data analytics, not plastics.
Not plastic. Yeah, I think we place an extremely high value on this data. We think that some very exciting things can be done with it. And, you know, we think that as time goes on, our airplanes, I mean, we've seen this happen in the air transport industry, where, you know, if 777 or a 787 takes off, it is riddled with sensors, thousands and thousands of sensors measuring everything that can possibly be measured. And all of that stuff, you know, goes to a data acquisition unit and then gets telemetered to the ground. And when the airplane lands in Tel Aviv, the mechanics in Tel Aviv already know that one of the tires on the right main gear is low on tire pressure and needs to be serviced immediately when the airplane lands, or, you know, or there's a problem with the air conditioning system. And that is really what's happened in the last decade in the airline industry. It's revolutionized their maintenance. And I think that's where the future lies for GA is in predictive analytics, where the airplane will be telling us what needs to be done rather than mechanics telling us what needs to be done. That's where I really see the future.
So if you could distill a single message to aircraft owners and pilots, what would that be?
Oh, my.
It doesn't have to be about data. It is.
Probably the single message that I would give to aircraft owners from my perspective is, be involved in the maintenance of your aircraft and stay in control of the maintenance of your aircraft. Don't abdicate your decision-making responsibility to mechanics, because they have a very different perspective on the world than aircraft owners do. And if you let mechanics make maintenance decisions for you, you typically will not be happy with the result. So I encourage aircraft owners to be activists when it comes to maintenance. It's a concept that I've called owner in command. We all are familiar with pilot in command when we're flying the airplane, but when the airplane's on the ground, and particularly when it's in the maintenance hangar, we need to be owner in command. We need to be the director of maintenance of our one airplane aviation department, and not just turn over the reins to A&Ps to make the decisions for us.
And not a lot of A&Ps appreciate when you're hanging out in the hangar with them and they're doing their thing. So what would be, could you distill a single message maybe to aviation mechanics? What would that be for them, since you work with them obviously very closely?
I guess the two messages that I would have for mechanics is, when an airplane comes in with a problem, resist the urge to attack it with tools, and instead try to gather as much data as you can in the most non-invasive possible way that you can in order to figure out what's wrong. There's just too much parts replacing in this business. There's too much taking things apart that don't need to be taken apart. The number of cylinders that are removed unnecessarily is absolutely appalling. Most problems that we have with cylinders can be corrected without removing the cylinder, and removing a cylinder from an aircraft engine is like, you know, cutting a big incision in the patient. The other message that I would have for mechanics is, don't treat aircraft owners as a bunch of dummies. Let them make the maintenance decisions on their aircraft. Consult with them. Do things the way they want them to be done, not the way you think they should be done. You're constrained by the FARs to do things in a proper fashion, and to if you're doing an annual, to make sure that the aircraft is airworthy before you sign off that annual. But within those constraints, the owner should be allowed to make the decisions and to call the shots. He should be encouraged to do that. Mechanics tend to be very, very averse to liability, and understandably so. But they're constantly taking on more liability than they need to, because every time they make a decision that the owner should have made, they're now responsible for that decision. And that's not really the way things are supposed to work. The owners are supposed to make the decision. GA is kind of unique in this regard because in the world of the airlines or the military, it's the owner of the aircraft that controls the maintenance of the aircraft. But in GA, the maintenance is typically not controlled by the owner. It should be. It needs to be. But it typically isn't. Most owners just put their airplane in the shop and then do what the shop tells them to do. That's not a good thing in my view. I like to see aircraft owners stay in control. I have a somewhat different perspective because I've only been an A&P for 20-some-odd years, but I've been an owner for 50-some-odd years. So my you know, although I put A&P IA at the end of my name, and I'm probably the best-known A&P IA in general aviation, my heart is with the aircraft owners. And everything that I've done is always to advocate on behalf of aircraft owners.
Yeah, that's completely self-evident just from today's conversation. And Mike, I thank you so much for joining me and joining the Airplane Geeks podcast today. We, like I said, we could go on for a long, 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 long time. And I know you need to go. So again, thanks so much for joining us today.
I do need to go, but it's been a lot of fun, Hillel, and I would be happy to do it again.
And I'd look forward to some next time when I can run into you and maybe you're not around, you know, surrounded by a crowd of fans and people that want to be you. So
yeah, the last week in July is never a good time to get me.
Yeah, well, we'll find you en route somewhere. So thanks again. And for the Airplane Geeks podcast, Hillel Glaser, switching to tower.
All right. So we want to thank Hillel for having that conversation. Hillel's been doing a number of interviews for us lately, which is greatly appreciated. And we have actually a few more that we haven't played yet, and those will come up in later episodes. As I mentioned, Hillel put together a little recording of definitions of some of the terms used in his conversation with Mike Bush from Savvy Aviation. If you're already aware of these kinds of terms, then just simply skip ahead.
Hi, Max and crew. Mike and I were so far into what we were discussing that there was no way we could stop to provide definitions for everything we were talking about. And it would have been great if we could, but there wasn't enough time and it was just would have been disruptive. So here are some definitions that you might want to listen to. So let's start off with, what is the manifold pressure? The manifold pressure controls how much pressure are in the cylinders for the engine to work with, to combust. In other words, it controls the power and the energy in the engine. The next definition is propeller pitch, or RPM. The propeller pitch, or RPM, works together with the manifold pressure to produce the overall picture of how much energy is moved by the engine, meaning how much air, which basically boils down to how fast you can go or how slow you can go without causing problems for the plane. So when someone says another definition is running square or flying square, what they often are referring to is that the gauge that reads manifold pressure and the gauge that reads propeller RPM are roughly the same. One would probably be in square inches of pressure, and the other would be in RPMs or hundreds of RPMs. So 24 square, for example, is 2400 RPM and 24 inches of manifold pressure, which would be a typical pressure for certain types of aircraft. Typical setting for certain types of aircraft. The engine RPM is controlled by the lever in the plane called a prop lever. What you're doing there is you're changing the angle of the propeller as it relates to the direction of the travel of the aircraft. So the angle facing forward of the propeller. And it's actually the angle of the propeller facing forward that determines how quickly the engine can rotate. And so you're balancing how fast the engine can rotate or how fast you're asking the engine to rotate with how much pressure is in the engine to create that rotation. So it's a balancing act that Mike and I started getting into when talking about flying the engine efficiently. But without these definitions, that conversation might have been very difficult to follow. So flying square or flying over square refers to the relationship between the manifold pressure and the engine RPM or the angle of the propeller. Some other terminology such as fuel flow simply means how many gallons per hour you're burning in the engines. EGT or exhaust gas temperature is the temperature of the exhaust gases coming out of the tailpipe of the plane. It's measured much closer to the engine itself. It's not actually the tailpipe. It's directly after the combustion happens. So the combustion happens, that combusted gases are exhausted through an exhaust system, through the exhaust valve, and that's where the EGT is, the exhaust gas temperature is measured. And what that tells you is how hot the exhaust is, which gives you an idea of how much energy is being burned, how much that energy is a function of gas and air mixing together, and you control that exhaust gas temperature with the with the mixture of the aircraft. So what we're referring to here are aircraft that are piston engines and are aspirated normally and are have the ability to control the mixture, which isn't done automatically for you by a system like in our most of our cars today. You actually control, is it a lot of air or a little air? And the more air, the richer the mixture, the less air, the leaner the mixture, which controls the ratio of fuel and air, which gives you a sense of when you try to combust the fuel in the air, how much air is there to combust compared to how much fuel is there to combust. At certain conditions, you need more air. And in other conditions, less air is simply better. And so that you're trying to burn purely fuel, and that's enough to keep the engine running. So those are a few terms. There's lean of peak and rich of peak. Simply means there's a point at which you are burning the peak amount of fuel. So that's peak. And you can be lean of peak, which means just slightly less air than peak. And rich of peak is anything more air than peak. Some aircraft fly better on lean of peak, most aircraft perhaps. A few may actually fly better on rich of peak. And there's a big debate on which is better for the plane. So we're not going to get into that. And the last thing that may have been mentioned is something called a magneto. The magneto in a piston aircraft provides the distribution of the sparks to the, well, there's a distributor, but the magneto basically ensures that the spark plugs get spark simply by the rotation of the engine. So you could lose your battery and you could lose your alternator, but the magneto would still provide spark to the engines so the engine doesn't stop for lack of electricity. And in some planes, many planes, actually one of the two magnetos helps start the engine. And in some planes, there are different things. So Mike made a reference to flying with a certain type of magneto. That's what he's referring to. So these are the definitions that may help as you listen to the episode.
What's up with the geeks? And Max Trescott, let's start with you.
I was just going to mention that, of course, we have had a lot of wildfires here in California, mostly in Northern California, most of them further north than where I am here in the San Francisco Bay Area, which a lot of people refer to as Northern California. I had a client contact me over the weekend to ask me if I would be able to help him get to Lake Tahoe in one of his airplanes to help fly back another one of his airplanes, which has been stuck there for a couple of weeks. And we've been looking at the forecast, and one of the options was to go up today. Well, this morning, when I first looked, it was a half-mile visibility in smoke. Now, that's not ground fog. It was about 3,000-foot overcast. Those are the clouds. But the visibility was a half-mile. Every time I looked today, the visibility at Truckee was 1/2 mile. I just looked a moment ago, and it's up to 1 mile visibility. Just to give people an idea, if you were flying IFR, at many airports, half mile would be the minimum visibility before you could land. Now, Truckee, they don't have an ILS. I'm quite sure that their visibility requirements are higher than 1/2 mile. So the airport's been pretty effectively closed. Clearly, we're not going up there anytime soon to get this airplane back until things recover. But anyway, just to let you know, there are a lot of sections in Northern California that are very heavily impacted by smoke right now, and that's impacting general aviation flying in and out of those areas.
Are these fires in California, or are these fires outside of California and the smoke is blowing into California?
Most of them are in California. One of them, I believe, has burned into Nevada. I think they said the Caldor fire is now the largest fire in the state. And I just read that it is moving toward the Lake Tahoe Basin where Truckee Airport is located. So I wouldn't think things would get better anytime soon. This all changes with the winds. We had about 8 weeks last year. We're in the San Francisco Bay Area. We had, I guess, on average, 3 to 4 mile visibility, which is pretty bad just because of smoke. Now, we've had some 6 mile visibility days this year, but nothing like last year. There was one day in early September where you may have seen photos where the sky was just completely orange. There are pictures of San Francisco with completely orange backgrounds all day long. We haven't seen anything like that again, but it's still a little early in fire season, so it's a little discouraging knowing that we've got a long ways to go.
Hmm. And we thought it was bad last year. I mean, that was a record breaker alone, I think, wasn't it, Max?
Yes, last year was by far the worst, and a lot of that was sparked by some summer lightning storms, which are rare around here, which started just a number of fires, which then merged together to make even bigger fires.
All right, Rob, how about you?
I just have a simple shout-out to a buddy of mine, Arne Quast, over here based in Chicago with a large airline, who shall go nameless, that happens to fly 787s out of O'Hare. And Artie just passed his captain type ride today in the 787. And he's jumping up and down. And, I mean, in a good way. And why is this guy of note? Because I have known him. But the first book I wrote about something about becoming a professional pilot, I interviewed somebody from this carrier, and they said, well, you ought to talk to one of our interns. And that's how Arne and I connected years ago. God, it's got to be 25 years now. And so he started out as an intern for this carrier, and now he's a 787 captain. And I think that's pretty damn cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Congratulations, Arne. You know, I have not yet flown on a 787.
All I remember is it's not very noisy and the windows are bigger.
Yeah, I've flown on just one, which was into Houston, as I recall, for United Airlines about 4 or 5 years ago. But, it was nice. My recollection is they've got electronically controlled tinting on the windows, which is kind of unusual. So to close the window, you throw a switch or something like that.
Yeah, and I think isn't the, the cabin pressurization at a lower altitude, I think, than is typically the case. And yeah, I think Boeing was in part one of their design objectives was to make it a passenger comfortable aircraft. And so, yeah, through the pressurization, the larger windows, the systems inside were kind of designed with that in mind. And I mean, everybody I know who's flown on a 787 just really enjoyed it. So, yeah, I'll have to go figure out someday.
Where well, it means leaving your camper at the airport because you cannot take it with you. It is not going to fit in the overhead compartment.
No, certainly not. Certainly not.
And someday, folks, if you ever see Max coming with his camper and you say, that's no camper, that's a little tank. That's Max.
Yeah, that's no camper. That's a mobile podcast recording studio. And I think that would be a little more difficult to do if you're on a 787, unless maybe you went into the bathroom, closed the door, and to kind of tried to record in there. That might work.
That might work. Well, I had hoped to take it down to Northern Virginia for the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum Innovations in Flight Day. That trip got canceled for me because of, this little thing called COVID. I'm fine, by the way. Vaccinated.
Oh, right. Are you okay, Max?
Yeah.
Okay, but enough about you. Let's talk about the listeners.
Let's talk about innovations in flight because it was really kind of a difficult year for that event. David, you were down for a little while.
Yeah, it was a good day. Amber and I went down. We went down Friday night. We got there bright and early at exactly at 10 a.m. The weather held out nicely. I know that Hillel was kind of freaking out because as the end of the day, the weather was starting to turn a bit foul and dark as in the direction of Baltimore where he needed to fly. But it was definitely a more scaled down event. I sort of got excited when a C-17 arrived at the airport, but we found out later that C-17 actually was from overseas, carrying people from Germany and Afghanistan. And the museum was in a different state. They're having some issues with their roof at the south end, where we usually have, if anyone knows the event, where we have our lunches. But a lot of the exhibits down at that end of the museum were completely covered. Of course, I did get to see a full-size X-Wing, which is located in the restoration facility, as well as Flakbait. Looks like she's made a little improvement. What was kind of neat was there was quite a few exhibits from the downtown museum, Amelia Earhart's Lockheed Vega, the Lockheed Cirrus that Annie and Charles Lindbergh flew, as well as the Curtiss RC-12 Racer, were all in the restoration hangar. But to everyone's chagrin, everybody was looking at the X-Wing and not the rest of the aircraft, and they should know. And the turnout was good outside, but like I said, it was definitely a much more subdued day. And I look forward to next year when hopefully things are back to normal and we can broadcast there and get more participation and less tension. Because wearing a mask, believe it or not, for 4.5 hours in the museum, it was a long day. The other part about it was one of the reasons why we decided to leave was the McDonald's no longer exists. So there is no food currently at the museum. And so it definitely took its toll. There was bottled water, but even as much as I complained about that McDonald's all these years, not having it was even worse than having the $40 Big Mac that they used to charge for there. So, but the museum is the museum. My guest had never been there with someone such a nerd as me, so she got an earful. But a lot of new exhibits. The Blue Angel F-18 Hornet was there on display. The Prowler, the EA-6B Prowler was there. And there was the SP-2C Helldiver was now next to the 35. And so our space was still there. And I looked over sort of longingly, wished that there was a table there that I could return to and get on the mic with my friends. But there's next year. So it's a step in the right direction. And we've got a little over a year, probably, or 8 months to get things, the ship righted, and we can be together all again.
So here's a question that you left behind a long time ago, but flak bait, that sounds like the name of a bomber. Is that what it is?
It's the highest mission count bomber for the United States Army Air Corps in World War II. It was a B-26B Marauder. Flak bait was, the front of it was down in the World War II hall in downtown, and that was just the front fuselage, the cockpit, and the top turret. Now they're in the process of restoring it completely to its full size with the wings and the rest of the fuselage, etc. What's interesting is if you go to the museum and you look at flak bait sitting there up on the nose, there's a big shiny metal spot. And ironically, they're torn whether they want to fix that or not. It is really all of the years of people rubbing the nose downtown have rubbed and polished the paint away. But, you know, in the Smithsonian's torn between, do we restore that section like we're planning on, or how they handle the restoration? The other thing about flak bait was they did find some shells inside the fuselage that were from one of the missions where they patched the holes, but the shells were still embedded in the fuselage. So flak bait's got a really beautiful history, and I'm looking forward to someday coming down there and seeing her all in one piece. Much like this was the first time I got to see the the owl, the German aircraft, the night fighter, finally had its wings and engines attached and the spaghetti. So that was kind of cool seeing that full size finally. So there was a lot to look at, but, you know, I miss the camaraderie of everybody and looking forward to the next time we all get together.
And I looked it up. 206 missions. That's what flak bait flew.
Wow. That's pretty impressive. Oh yeah, it pained me that I couldn't come down for that, David. But as you say, there's next year, and hopefully things will be quite a bit different.
Which is exactly what we said this time last year. Do you remember that?
Yes, I know.
Well, but in all fairness, last year we didn't have it at all. So it's
Oh, good point. It is
making
getting
progress.
And let's not forget that this year was special because Max made it to Air Venture.
Yeah. Can you believe it? No, I don't have to listen to you give me a hard time.
That's true.
Oh, well, sure. You know,
it'll Linda change. Charmed everybody, so it was hard to complain about Max. I mean, but again, the tank was just, that was something I wasn't prepared for.
So you realize, Max, that the goal constantly moves. So in the coming year, it'll be, you've only been there once?
Right. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. We do have one shout-out from Micah. This is an obituary, actually. Pierre Spray, Pentagon analyst who battled brass to produce A-10 warplane, dies at 83. And I was really not familiar with the history of this gentleman. Sounds like kind of a character, strong-willed kind of a guy. They called him something like that, a polymath, which that's a word I never use, a polymath whose interests encompassed history, engineering, and French literature. So I guess from that you can figure out what a polymath is. But he also established a jazz record label, produced lots of recordings. They were known for high fidelity. But I guess he had opinions about the Pentagon, what they should do, what they shouldn't do. and was kind of active in terms of maybe influencing policy, maybe? I'm not sure. But we'll have a link to that in the show notes. So we'll wrap it up with that. We want to thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. I want to thank Hillel for recording the conversation with Mike Bush. Of course, he's the founder and CEO of Savvy Aviation. You can find them at savvyaviation.com. You can find us at airplanegeeks.com. Show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com/667. And the usual email address where you can reach us is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. All right, Mr. Trescott, where do we find you?
Mr. Trescott. Oh, no, no, please, please, please call me Mr. Max Trescott. No, I think that was an old line from Steve Martin years ago. Let's see. You can always find me by going out to aviationnewstalk.com, click on contact at the top of the page, and also check out the Aviation News Talk podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
And Rob Mark.
They can find me at jetwine.com and soon to be at various and sundry other aviation publications for which I am now contributing. So it's going to be as much a surprise to me as it probably will be to you guys.
Okay. No, I think it's pretty easy to narrow down. We'll just look for the sundry publications, and we'll know those are the ones you're writing for.
That's right. That's true. That's true. I didn't think anybody was going to pick up on that clue.
David Vanderhoof, how about you?
Well, you can, of course, find me on our Slack listener team, and you can do that by sending us an email to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And then, of course, you can find me on various social media and, of course, at the American Helicopter Museum.
Very good. And, of course, you can find me at 30,000feet.com. That'll point you to all the places where I hang out. And so we'll ask you to please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
Nighty-night.
And thanks for listening.